Do we just choose one, or?
There is no definite answer to it, because when it comes to the supplications, people ask the same question. When it comes to adhkar, people ask the same question. Is Allahu Akbar better, or Salawat, for example?
Exactly, yeah.
I believe that we cannot find a certain answer to this question. As you mentioned, it might be better if people can do all of them. If not, they may choose the one that they feel comfortable to memorize or to say and recite and read. But to, do, for example, two or three, it would be, inshallah, more effective. So it's always better to The more the better, exactly. Also, to carry some supplications with us. We know that some people, sometimes they have a small paper, or in other form, they carry some chapters of the Quran. It's been mentioned by the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt that it's effective. We see that especially for the babies, the believers do that. They have some...
some talisman, some hirz, we say.
Yeah, exactly. In it, it's been mentioned by the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt that chapter Ham, chapter Tawheed, An-Nas, Al-Falaq, Ayatul Kursi to be written, for example. And I'll go back to the other question, that when we see the goodness, the success of other people, how can we protect other people from our evil eye? As I mentioned, one of them is that I'm narrating a narration from our Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family. He says that when you see something which surprises you, say, MashaAllah, la quwwata illa billah. You see that this is a custom among many believers. When they see something great in other people, they say, MashaAllah.
They attribute it directly to
exactly
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
And according to this narration, it's great to continue and say, MashaAllah, la quwwata illa billah. And the last point that I believe it could be also of great help is that it's not necessary for us to share all the success that we have with other people. I'm not talking about our scientific success, for example. You see, nowadays, especially in social media, as soon as a person buys something new for his or her house, which is very beautiful, a fancy car, whatever, they try to share that with their friends, their relatives, and so on and so forth. There is no need to that. One of the ways that we can protect ourselves from the evil eye...
Not overindulge, overshare.
Exactly. To avoid sharing what is not necessary. Sometimes I tell the people that, for example, I have a PhD in Quranic studies. I have obtained my PhD, for example. So people can, later take benefits from my knowledge. But sometimes
that
we are telling...
That makes sense, yeah.
Yeah, it makes sense. But sometimes we say that today I bought this new carpet, see how...
I bought this bag, bought this wallet, and I went to this restaurant.
Exactly.
Maybe even gloating a little bit.
Yeah. And we are, encouraging people to do evil eye regarding
exactly,
us.
Exactly, yes.
So as long as it's not necessary, we can avoid sharing these, worldly so-called pleasures with other people.
Exactly, yeah.
And maybe through that, we can also be protected from the evil eye of the people.
But just an important point. This does not mean do not share with your family. No, our friends, do share with your family. Just do not overindulge.
Exactly. That's the point, yeah.
So just a question. If you said, dear Sheikh, that the evil eye can also be caused unintentionally by a believer, by a mu'min. The question, therefore, is, I, as a believer... unintentionally, I caused a harmful effect on another mu'min. Will I be punished for this by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Will I have sinned for doing this unintentionally?
There are two points. First of all, no one, I believe, can say that for 100% because of the fact that I looked at this person, such and such happened for him or her.
True.
Are you sure that because of the fact that you went to your friend's house, you saw his son... and the next day the son became sick, it is because of the fact that you saw him? No one is sure about that. And second of all, no person is going to be punished for unintentional acts. So evil eye is not intentional. is not intentional. It is not within our control. So Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is not going to punish us. But maybe we can, as a kind of recommendation, we can ask the people who may come to this conclusion that, yes, I'm suffering from evil eye, they may do what we mentioned today, to say, for example, MashaAllah, la quwwata illa billah, to say Allahu Akbar, la hawla wa la quwwata illa billah. So it's just a kind of recommendation, but we cannot say that they will be punished because of the fact that they are suffering from evil eye.
Dear Sheikh, thank you very much for your time. Unfortunately, our session today is unfortunately up. This has yet again been your host, Musa Al-Bahadili, from your program Q&A on Islamic Beliefs, broadcasting to you from IRIB English Radio. Thank you for tuning in. Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Ali wa Hussein wa Hassan. Ali wa Hussein wa Hassan. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا وبهذا الحب لا نخشى المحن Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Shiraz Agha. Thank you for joining us here today. We've been speaking about the necessity of prophethood. Today we're going to speak about this a little more. We said that in order for a human being to achieve felicity in this world and in the hereafter, he has to have a certain type of knowledge, a knowledge about his creator, about who he is, where he is, where he's going, and what is the end of his existence, what is the goal of his existence. All of these things are required this knowledge of these things are required for a man to be felicious and to be happy, to be fulfilled in this world. And we said that this is not something that a man can arrive at on his own. Rather, he needs the assistance of the divine revelation. We said that it's possible for somebody to raise the following objection here, and say this: that we see that there have been certain thinkers throughout the history of human thought who have arrived at the same conclusions as the divine revelation speaks about. They also believed in God. They believed in His oneness. They believed in His infinite power. They believed in the eternity of the human soul. That God will recompense human beings for their actions in this world, in another world, that He will punish those people who were evil in this world, and so on and so forth. All of these conclusions, all of these things that the divine revelation speaks about, there have been thinkers who have arrived at the same conclusion using their minds, using their powers of reason, without the assistance of divine revelation. What is the need for divine revelation? And why is it that we are required, God is required to teach us about these things through revelation? He doesn't need to tell us about it. He's given us the faculty of reasoning, and we can use it to arrive at these conclusions. We've been examining this question and answering it from different points of view. one of the ways that we can discuss this is from this point of view, and look at by looking at the limitations of the powers of reasoning, and say this, that reasoning only has the ability to understand certain general and universal principles. Without the assistance of some other faculty, regardless of whether that faculty is within man or outside of man, it can't understand certain details about the conclusions it has arrived at on its own. For example, if you look outside, without looking outside, your mind can't tell you whether it's night or day, right? In a similar manner, there has to be a particular faculty which has particular knowledge about the other world, right, after this world, which can tell us what are the conclusions and results and effects of the actions we perform in this world and in the next world. For example, we know that if we perform an evil action, it's going to have an effect in the hereafter. But what that is, we don't know. For example, Revelation tells us that when somebody lies in the hereafter, he's going to be Muslim. He's going to be, for example, he's going to be fed fire. Or when somebody usurps the wealth of an orphan, in the other world, it manifests itself in the form of fire, a person eating fire and fire entering his stomach. This is something that the power of reason cannot arrive at without the assistance of a particular faculty. And this is not something, at the same time, it's not something that the senses can assist him in. So there has to be another means of knowledge, and that is the divine revelation. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were examining the problem of the divine revelation. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussain Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Communique.
The People's Mujahideen of Iran, also known as the MEK or MKO, is a very controversial group with a controversial past. Banned in Iran and Iraq, it once stood on the United States list of terrorist organizations, worked with Saddam Hussein, helped the Israelis, and is now exiled in Albania, receiving funding from Saudi Arabia. The group's number one goal is to overthrow the Islamic Republic of Iran through violent means and install a new government. In Iran, the group has killed thousands of civilians, assassinated dozens of high-ranking government officials, and even targeted Americans and other foreigners too. They claim to stand for human rights and democracy, but are they really the democratic opposition to Iran that they market themselves as?
I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
The People's Mujahideen of Iran, also called the MEK or MKO, first started out in Iran as a political group in the 1960s, with its ideology initially rooted in Marxism, feminism, and Islamism. The group was anti-US, taking a harsh stance against Western ideology and capitalism. It opposed the Shah, the US-backed puppet ruler of Iran at the time. And the MEK was initially made up largely of students and middle-class Iranians. During the Islamic Revolution in 1979, the group did play a role in the overthrow of the Shah. However, the degree to which they helped accomplish this appears to be somewhat exaggerated by the MEK. In the first days of the Islamic Republic, the MEK suffered numerous political defeats in Iran. It opposed the country's draft constitution and boycotted its referendum in 1979, a referendum which ultimately passed and was approved by a majority of Iranians. The group was consequently not allowed to participate in the presidential elections and took a huge loss in parliamentary elections, failing to win even a single seat. After failing to gain any traction and coming out of the legislative and electoral process with no viable path forward, the MEK began threatening to take up arms against the Islamic Republic and commenced a ruthless bombing campaign across Iran. On June 28, 1981, the MEK blew up the headquarters of the Islamic Republican Party. This massive explosion killed 72 officials, including the Chief Justice and Party Secretary Ayatollah Mohammad Beheshti, who also played a pivotal role in the Islamic Revolution. Among the 72 martyred were four cabinet ministers, the ministers of health, transport, telecommunications, and energy, as well as 27 members of Iran's parliament, the Mejlis, and other important political and military figures in Iran. This terrorist attack is known as the Haftatir bombing. The MEK has neither denied nor confirmed responsibility, although their responsibility for the attack is commonly accepted both inside Iran and outside, as the group has publicly approved of this attack, and even the United States government itself cited this terrorist attack in a 2005 country report on Iran. 2 months later, in August 1981, the MEK bombed the offices of then Prime Minister Mohammad Jawad Bahana. The explosion killed both the Prime Minister, the Chief of Police, and the President, Mohammad Ali Rajai. The group's violence has not just been limited to Iranians and has even targeted foreigners. By the U.S. own admission, during the 1970s, the MEK killed three U.S. Army colonels as well as three U.S. contractors. The group has also tried to assassinate the general command of the U.S. military mission and attacked numerous facilities in Iran belonging to American companies such as Pepsi, Shell Oil, Pan Am Airlines, General Motors, and more. During Saddam Hussein's violent war against Iran from 1980 to 1988, Iran was attacked by Iraq, who was supported at the time both by the Americans and the British, who had given Saddam Hussein chemical weapons. During this period, Saddam Hussein allied himself with the MEK and incorporated them into his assault against Iran, providing the group with weaponry, money, and logistical support. This proved to be yet another huge mistake on the MEK's part. Not only did their violent plans to overthrow the Iranian government fail to materialize, but the fact that they had begun working with Saddam Hussein made their reputation even worse, causing them to effectively lose all support domestically. This earned them the nickname Munafiqeen, or hypocrites. Their actions were seen as treasonous, for they had now sided with a foreign country and taken up arms with Saddam against their fellow countrymen in Iran. This would end up becoming a common theme for the MEK, for although the organization claims to be fighting for Iranians, it is in fact not based in Iran. After being exiled, the group relocated from Iran to France, from France to Iraq, and now finds itself in Albania. Knowing that it lacks any popular support at home, during the last decades, the MEK has enjoyed varying levels of support from foreign governments. This includes financial backing as well as logistical, political, and military support, not just from Saddam's Iraq, but also from other Arab countries and Western countries too. Although the MEK was once listed as a terrorist organization in the US and UK, this is no longer the case. Several US politicians, lawmakers, and military officials have participated in or attended MEK events and received thousands of dollars from the group. A Guardian investigation from 2012 shows how several key figures in the US, ranging from lawmakers, former officials, and DC lobby groups, were the recipients of large sums of money from the MEK. The MEK sought to bribe them into delisting the organization as a terror group, and these efforts ultimately proved to be successful when former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton removed the MEK from the US list of terrorist groups in 2012. Since then, the cash flow has not ceased, as we've seen more recently former New York mayor and Donald Trump's lawyer Rudy Giuliani, as well as former National Security Advisor John Bolton, both taking money from the MEK. In present times, Saudi Arabia is widely considered to be the group's largest financial backer. And if working with Saddam Hussein wasn't enough, the MEK has also cooperated with the Israelis on numerous occasions against Iran. In recent times, the MEK fabricated claims that Tehran was pursuing a nuclear weapons program and assisted the Israelis in fabricating and disseminating false documents to that effect. Between the years 2010 and 2012, Israel is known to have carried out the assassinations of several prominent nuclear scientists in Iran. The MEK was involved in those killings and received funding, financing, and training from the Israelis. The latest assassination in late 2020 of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh is also believed to have been carried out by the Israelis, again in cooperation with the MEK. Now, with President-elect Raisi's landslide victory, the MEK has attempted to renew its efforts against Iran and rally more people around its cause. The group cites Raisi's long-term career in the judiciary as a point of contention. However, it admits recently in the press that it doesn't matter who had won the election because they are opposed to everyone. After all, the stated goal of the MEK is to overthrow the Islamic Republic in its entirety, and they deem all political movements in Iran, whether principalist or moderate or reformist, to be the same in their view. And in order to help them do that, they're willing to enlist the help of foreign governments in Europe, in America, and have been more than willing to use their help in subverting and attacking the Islamic Republic. On the weekend of July 10th, 2021, the so-called Free Iran World Summit taking place. This is a three-day online event promoting the MEK and its movement to overthrow the Islamic Republic of Iran. It's basically a get-together between MEK members and foreign politicians where they collectively bash Iran, call its elections fraudulent, which is convenient given that the MEK has never won a single seat in parliament, and repeat the usual propaganda about a nuclear weapons program that doesn't exist, and so on. Now, leading the MEK's event is the current head, Maryam Rajavi. This event includes speakers such as former Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper, the former Italian Minister of Foreign Affairs, the former Prime Minister of Albania. Also speaking at the event are dozens of U.S. senators and House members from both the Democratic and Republican parties, including Senators Robert Menendez, Ted Cruz, Roy Blunt, Ben Cardin, and Congressman Kevin McCarthy and Hakeem Jeffries. Also present is General James Jones, who used to be President Obama's National Security Advisor, and several former European ministers, including the former foreign ministers of France, Italy, Poland, the former British and French defense ministers, and the leader of Europe's People's Party, the largest in Europe. What I've just read to you is straight from the event's website. As you can see, this is a long, long list of high-ranking officials, foreign dignitaries, and lawmakers from all across the Western world who clearly have no problem attending the event of a terrorist group that has literally assassinated an Iranian president, an Iranian prime minister, dozens of government officials, and taken up arms with Israel against their own countrymen in Iran. Then these Western politicians, in the same breath, have the gall to call Iran a terrorist state as they literally sit and speak with terrorists themselves. After all, are we surprised? This is no different from seeing Senator John McCain posing with Al-Qaeda fighters after illegally entering Syria, or Donald Rumsfeld shaking hands with Saddam Hussein, and so on and so forth. Bipartisanship for regime change is always there, and the United States and its allies literally make money from sponsoring terrorism. That's all their foreign policy is, overthrowing governments and countries they don't like so that they can steal their land and control their resources. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Now joining me to discuss more is Anne-Hoda Bande. She's an expert on the methodology of radicalization and cultic abuse and terrorism. Thank you so much for taking the time, Anne. It's a pleasure to have you on.
You're welcome.
The MEK, or the People's Mujahideen, they've moved headquarters several times in the last years. They're currently based in Albania. Could you maybe tell us a bit about that, how it came to be that they've moved headquarters several times and what they're doing in Albania right now?
Well, I'll just skip back 20 years with the invasion of Iraq. And of course, Mujahideen were hand in hand with the Saddam regime. And so they had a massive base there, a military base, and they were sort of launching attacks into Iran from Iraq. That all ended, of course, in 2003. And they were corralled into one base, disarmed by the US Army, and sort of left while everybody figured out what to do with them. From there, from Camp Ashraf in the Diyali province, they went to a base just outside Baghdad with a view to actually moving them out of the country. Of course, in the meantime, Mariam Rajavi was in Paris. She came over there 30 years ago, but the main body of the organization had been stuck in Iraq for you know, three decades since the revolution. Hillary Clinton managed to persuade the Albanian government at the time, the Prime Minister was Salih Berisha, and said, you know, we'll take this organization on. So that was the deal in 2013. In 2016, they started sending people there. Mariam Rajavi continued in France. The every major city, Europe, North America, had a kind of a cell of the MEK. The people who came to Albania did so essentially without any ID documents. The UNHCR, which was actually responsible for moving them, gave each of them a document which said, I am being transferred for humanitarian reasons. And they just basically had their name, whichever name they chose to give, because a lot of them came with false names, and it's actually not known exactly who they are, although most of them are known to, you know, the intelligence services of all the countries that they're in. So they ended up as a group in Albania. Now, the reason Mariam Rajavi is now in Albania holding her meeting is because she's been expelled from Europe. That was 2018. I think things came to a head with the intelligence services. They assessed this group in their sphere, the EU, as a risk.
Right. I mean, we recall that several U.S. officials are on the payroll of the MEK, and Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, she removed them off the list of terrorist organizations. Does the United States have a long-term agenda at play here in supporting the MEK?
Simple answer, yes. You know, the Americans, well, I say support, and Americans' involvement with the Mujahideen goes way, way back to after they left Iran, after the revolution, they were pushed out. And it was, in fact, the French CIA who sort of brokered a deal with France to take them there, give them a base, give them some land, let them sort of establish a headquarters there. And I'm sure somewhere along the line you'll find the name Donald Rumsfeld among those deals that took place. Yeah, what a guy. And also, you know, Donald Rumsfeld basically gifted the MEK to Saddam Hussein. France was saying, well, you know, I don't want these people, what can we do? So they sent Massoud Rajavi, who was leader at the time, to Iraq. The Americans have kind of kept them at arm's length. None of the top leaders have ever been allowed into America. Mariam Rajavi was desperate to try and get in. Back in 94, 95, 96, she came back to Europe. America has refused her a visa all that time. The UK managed to kind of give her a short sort of overnight trip to have a meeting and then sent her straight back to France. And France has tolerated her because it had to. But all this time, yes, the anti-Iran American European crowd have found the Mujahideen a very useful kind of tool to amplify their agenda, to pass off information like the nuclear revelations. And you will find, yes, that they have been, I mean, people like John Bolton, although people like him are paid for meetings, and it's quite open that the Mujahideen pay these people, but very often they're quite actually, you know, they really believe that the Mujahideen are sort of an opposition group and can overthrow the regime and make a difference to the situation there. So yes, the American involvement, and it isn't just the Republicans, the Democrats, it's the bipartisan support, and it's in individuals rather than government. The only government in the world after Saddam Hussein who's actually supported the Mujahideen has been Albanian government, unfortunately.
Right, and I mean, just generally speaking, what would you say is the current level of support that they enjoy from the Biden administration and other European countries or Arab countries at the moment?
In terms of the Biden administration, I I sincerely hope that there's a memo gone out from the Defense Department and the Department of State to sort of say, look, you know, drop this group. Certainly, I think among the actual officials in those ministries, there's a very sort of profound understanding that this group is not, it's a toxic group and it shouldn't be supported. And the only people who do continue to support them are paid, as we'll see in the meeting today. In Europe, again, you know, the Mujahideen made themselves so impossible by constantly invading the European Parliament, harassing MEPs, lobbying, you know, left, right and centre, and I think it was a sense of relief when they were actually sent out of the European Union and kind of, you know, they no longer have to tolerate this interference in their foreign affairs and such like.
You know, when you mention this meeting, and, you know, we are also talking about the Free Iran Global Summit that's being held, could you maybe tell us a bit more about this and what exactly the agenda is?
They practically exist only through propaganda, especially since 2003, when they were disarmed and they could no longer sort of participate in their previous incarnation of a military force and try and attack Iran. So they've really taken on the mantle of being a propaganda outfit. And the sort of rallies which they held in Paris every year on the anniversary of their armed uprising, basically. So they've held this rally every year. Various capitals, the Washington, London, Paris, of course, Cologne, they would have these meetings, these rallies, and get the invited guests in. So there's no change there. It is just more of the same. The difference now, of course, is they're in Albania. They have it's online because they can't meet, obviously, in person because of the COVID restrictions. But essentially, it is Mariam Rajavi self-publicising and getting together a whole group of anti-Iran speakers who will talk about perhaps a regime change or how President Ebrahim Raisi is a murderer and a criminal. And it's their way of actually staying alive, essentially.
The MEK, do they actually have any viable path to power? Because they claim to be in opposition to the Iranian government. They claim to propose an alternative. But what actually is it that they have to offer to the Iranian people? How do they market themselves as champions of human rights and democracy, given all of these things that they've done that you just mentioned as well?
Yeah, sure. So the Mujahideen, they've sort of promised, let's say, regime change, but there's no indication from the Iranian people that they're actually kind of, you know, sitting there waiting for Mariam Rajavi to go and rescue them. And, you know, the country's moved on in 40 years, and the Mujahideen, unfortunately, have really kind of lost the plot big time. Mujahideen have no support at all in Iran, let's say, even if people have heard of them, because, you know, many people have been born in the last 20 years have never even heard of the Mujahideen. They're promoting sort of a regime change agenda which relies totally on the Americans attacking Iran. And you know, it's nothing, they will not actually, even the America has said, you know, we really don't want to involve them, we just want to use them. Now, the meeting, the rallies that's held this weekend, the focus of that, Mariam Rajavi has said, we must look at Ebrahim Raisi's record, events that took place 30 years ago at the end of the Iran-Iraq war. And that's the focus of her propaganda rally. The question that needs to be asked of Mariam Rajavi is, well, what about your human rights record? What about the war crimes you committed against the Kurds, against the Shias in the south of Iraq back in the first Gulf War? What about the crimes against humanity that you've committed by, you know, killing so many civilians, your terrorist activities? But more than anything, people need to ask, you know, how are you able to treat your followers as slaves? As I said, they were brought from Iraq without documentation. They're stateless people. They are not allowed to marry, form relationships. They cannot think for themselves. They have no choice about what they believe in. They have no life.
Anne Khodabande, thank you so much for your time, for coming on the program. Really grateful for your insight and analysis.
You're welcome. Thank you.
It is unequivocal that the group's history is a long and violent one. The MEK attempted several violent power grabs in the Islamic Republic, killing almost 100 officials. It assassinated Iran's president, Iran's prime minister, and chief of police, and then tried to assassinate another two of its presidents. It helped Saddam Hussein attack Iran. It helped Israel assassinate Iranian nuclear scientists and has received funding from Saudi Arabia and other foreign governments who have shown nothing but animosity towards the Iranian Islamic Republic. All in all, the combined terrorist activities of the MEK, in addition to their collaboration with Saddam Hussein in the Iran-Iraq war, have caused the death of around 17,000 Iranians. This shows that Iran has suffered some of the worst terrorist atrocities in modern history, carried out by groups that the United States and its allies openly support. So when we hear from former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo or other American officials and European officials who outrageously claim that Iran is a, quote, state sponsor of terrorism, ask yourself, who has supported the MEK after all its terrorist attacks and assassinations? Who has supported Israel in the targeted killings of Iranian nuclear scientists? Who armed and supported Saddam Hussein to attack Iran and assists other countries and parties in the region to do the same? Has Iran ever financed and trained violent groups inside the U.S. to overthrow the U.S. government or helped neighboring countries to fight wars against the U.S.? Certainly not. And yet the U.S. comes along and has the gall to accuse Iran of being a sponsor of terrorism. The hypocrisy is staggering. The United States and its allies do not care about instating supposed democracy in Iran. And even if they did, the MEK is hardly an appropriate choice. It's apparent that while the group claims that it aims to promote human rights and democracy, its activities and practices paint a completely different picture. It's evident that the group also lacks a real support base in Iran. It has no viable path to achieving its stated goals, nor does it seem to propose any concrete alternatives for the Iranian people to better their lives. The various backers of the MEK are aware that the group has no popular support in Iran and no path to power. For the Americans, the Saudis, and Israelis, the MEK is just a proxy tool that they can use to spite Tehran and attack Iran under the false pretense that it constitutes some sort of democratic opposition, despite its long and violent history. After all, the United States itself has a long and violent history of arming and training terrorist groups in pursuit of its foreign policy objectives, as we've seen in Latin America, Central America, more recently in Syria, and numerous other places. It's unsurprising that the West would delist this group as a terrorist organization and offer it cover and funding. They're not interested in what the MEK does or has done, so long as the MEK does their bidding and continues to attack and harass Iran, being a thorn in its side and sowing chaos in the country. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, ways to teach compassion. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Brothers and sisters, we've been talking about compassion. And this is, you know, today we want to bring up how you can teach compassion to your children. Because we, at the end of the day, want to leave this heritage for our next generation. So how can we teach them to be more compassionate towards other human beings? Well, the first tip is talk the talk. Most children can learn about true compassion by seeing and feeling this trait acted out. But when parents talk explicitly about acts of compassion, they communicate its importance as a prized family value. As you watch television or movies with your children, you know, I'm sure you watch Islamic movies here and there, Be sure to point out instances where compassion was shown or should have been shown, for example. Talk about people who particularly need compassion, such as the elderly and children living in poverty. The second tip is walk the talk. Children may listen to your words, but more importantly, they learn from observing your actions. When you have a chance to practice a random act of compassion, do so. When you are frustrated in an interpersonal interaction, express your displeasure in words that show respect for the dignity of the person you are addressing. When you encounter a person who needs help, stop what you are doing and attend to them, even especially if it is not particularly convenient for you to do so. Show young people that any time is the right time to engage in acts of service and compassion for others. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we are talking about ways to teach compassion to our next generation, especially our own children. We discussed two of them. First one is talk the talk. The second one is walk the talk. And now let's talk about the third one. Put the child on the receiving end of compassion. While showing compassion to others is a top way to teach this value to a child, allowing a young person to experience compassion firsthand is even more impactful. Fourth one is volunteer your time. When children become actively involved in acts of showing compassion to others, they learn about this value in a very deep and enduring way. Find age-appropriate ways to introduce your child to volunteering, such as visiting a patient and taking a meal for them, volunteering at the local masjid or Islamic center, volunteering for an Islamic project. It could be an Islamic project on ground or in cyberspace. Last but not the least, make a wish. Acts of life-changing compassion can be only a click away. Use the internet to introduce your children to different charitable organizations that provide compassionate assistance to others. The Make-A-Wish Foundation provides hope, strength, and joy to children with life-threatening medical conditions. So, you know, you try to give them a dream organization, or a dream foundation that your child can build in future to make this world a better place to live. This way, this child of yours grows up with this dream foundation, this dream organization, this dream collective work to make this world a better place to live. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Climate scientists were stunned by the intensity of flooding in Germany and Belgium that killed at least 120 people and damaged tens of thousands of homes, with experts saying they did not expect such extreme weather to result from the human-caused climate crisis as rapidly as it has. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Julia Conley Ryder. This article is published under the heading Climate Experts Shocked at Severity of Floods in Germany and Belgium. Here is more on the story. Scientists recently were stunned by the intensity of flooding in Germany and Belgium that killed at least 120 people and damaged tens of thousands of homes, with experts saying they did not expect such extreme weather to result from the human-caused climate crisis as rapidly as it has. More than a dozen records for rainfall were set across Western Europe, including in Cologne, where officials recorded 6 inches of rainfall in just 24 hours, nearly double the monthly average for July. The city's previous record for daily rainfall was only 3 inches. This week's event is totally untypical for that region. Dieter Gerten, professor of global change, climatology, and hydrology at the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research, told The Guardian. Aerial footage of Ahrweiler in Rhineland-Palatinate showed fallen trees, abandoned cars, and inundated roads. According to the European Severe Weather Database, Rafshard saw more than 8 inches of rainfall in just 9 hours, leading to extreme flash flooding. Recently, officials reported that as many as 1,300 people were still unaccounted for, noting that the high number could be related to power supplies and cell phone networks being disrupted and some areas being difficult for rescue crews to reach. Gerten expressed shock at the severity of the disaster. "We seem to be not just above normal, but in domains we didn't expect in terms of spatial extent and the spread it developed," Gerten said. Climate scientists have warned for years that the continued extraction of fossil fuels is causing numerous changes in the climate. including extreme heat, drought, and more frequent and heavy rain, which has been linked to the warming of oceans and increased amounts of water evaporating into the air. With climate change, we do expect all hydrometeorological extremes to become more extreme. What we have seen in Germany is broadly consistent with this trend. Carlo Bontempo, director of the Copernicus Climate Change Service at the European Center for Medium-Range Weather Forecast, told The Guardian. But, as reports said, scientists said they failed to predict the intensity of the German floods, as well as the extreme heat which enveloped the western United States and Canada in recent weeks, killing hundreds of people. The obvious acceleration of the breakdown of stable climate simply confirms that when it comes to the climate emergency, we are in deep, deep trouble. Bill Maguire, a professor emeritus of geophysical and climate hazards at University College London, said. The effects of the torrential downpour stretched across Western Europe, with officials in Belgium saying at least 23 people were confirmed dead and at least 19 were missing, and experts in the Netherlands and Switzerland expecting more inundation recently. We're still waiting for a definitive toll, but it could be that this flood becomes the most catastrophic our country has ever known, said Belgian Prime Minister Alexander De Croo recently. And social media progressive organizer Doyle Canning of Oregon, where temperatures reached 116 degrees earlier this month, responded to a video of flash flooding in one German city. "This is your climate on fossil fuel," said Canning as she reshared the footage. The flooding came days after the European Union unveiled a plan to transition away from fossil fuels by 2030 as part of its plan to become carbon neutral by 2050. Armin Laschet, the governor of one of Germany's hardest hit states and a candidate to replace Angela Merkel as chancellor in September election, said the rising death toll and damage to communities across Germany demonstrated that we need to continue Germany's path toward climate neutrality even faster.
Aperture. Welcome back to Aperture. We witnessed the spectacular and awe-inspiring natural beauty of the Kaluts or Yardangs in the western part of Dashtalut in Iran. Rising up to 80 meters, these streamlined ridges have been carved by the wind out of the clay and sand lining the desert floor, creating a magnificent array of high-rising sculptures and lying parallel to the prevailing winds. The Yardangs are some of the world's most prominent. Stay with us as we follow Javad Gharayi, an Iranian nature explorer and documentary filmmaker, as he introduces more of Iran's desert wonders to us.
Early the next morning, I was still sleepy and tired, but some of the most beautiful natural views revealed themselves in the moments before sunrise. The cold and the dark couldn't stop me from exploring the natural beauties near my camp. The early hours of morning in the natural world fills you with energy. filled to the brim with that energy that emanates from the peace and tranquility bestowed upon this land by God Almighty. I started my day that promised to be a good one. I spent 3 hours exploring the areas around my tent, taking beautiful photos of the unmatched scenery of the Kaluts, a precious gift by Mother Nature to those who appreciate her. It was time for me to leave the imaginary city of Kaluts, a city with great potential for becoming a destination for responsible tourists and nature travelers. The most beautiful natural scenes should either be visited in the early hours of morning or sometime around sundown. I got up at 6 o'clock this morning and was able to take spectacular snaps of the natural beauties around here with this very camera. I have to say, I love Iran with all my being because of its very rich culture and its remarkably diverse natural beauties. It's time to go now. I have to pack up. I gotta put my tent back into my backpack and head out for the Kaluts again. This is my last day here. I can't stay here much longer because I'm running out of food and water. Not only the Kaluts, but the entire vast Lut region are considered as an invaluable natural museum in the world. All by itself, the Lut Desert is home to a world of numerous beauties, the like of which are scattered in different places across our planet. Without a doubt, it's among the most beautiful deserts on Earth. The Yalon mega dunes with their rare views, the Kaluts, the star-shaped dunes, the beautiful valleys in the heart of Lut, the hottest part of Dashtalut, which is Gandum Berian, a large plateau covered in dark lava, the unique vegetation, including small trees named Saxols, the Martian or miniature mountains on the fringes of Lut, the central hole, the Dolphin Valley comprised of rock formations eroded by wind, Dashtakashk, and the plant and animal species endemic to Lut. Add to all that the villages with their unique desert architecture, people whose cultures go back 6,000 years. My GPS is telling me I've walked around 36 kilometers through the Kaluts. This is nearly the end of my trek into the Kaluts. Another very beautiful feature of the Kaluts of Kerman, in other words, the Kaluts of Shahdad, is the Nepka Forest Park. These very beautiful plants you see behind me here are in fact the trees that have formed this Nepka Forest Park. Only two species, salt cedars and saxols, which have grown here and created this beautiful and unique landscape. This area obviously looks different from others. The Nepka's Forest Park forms the vegetation on the fringe of the Kalut area.